Well, good morning and welcome to Conversations. My name is Ed Hollihan, and my guest today is Eddie Nix, owner and operator of Driftless Books and Music, founding member of a Driftless Community Radio, actor, producer, philanthropist, collector of treasure, fluent in the plays of Edward de Vere. We'll get to that today. DJ, radio host, man about town, and raconteur extraordinaire. Welcome, Eddie. Stop wincing.
Welcome.
Good to see you.
Thank you, Ed. It's lovely.
Yeah, it will be. I'm so looking forward to this. Well, let's diverge right from the beginning. There are two or three, or maybe seven great radio voices in the world, and you own one of them, and thank you for that. Long may you wave. It is so fun to hear you introduce your Sunday night show with the unswept corners and that sort of intro. It's such good stuff. Thank you.
Well, it's fun. It's complexly folk.
Yes.
It's Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. And the royal we,
right,
plays a lot of just weird folk music, or folk adjacent, I like to say.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
I probably shouldn't bring this up either, but last Sunday's was in conflict with a certain football game, which might as well get it over with.
Yeah.
I've never seen an uglier football game in my life.
Oh, God.
It was like watching what? It was like...
it was so sad, yeah.
Is there an analogy?
It's hard sometimes because... yeah, you have to kind of like watch the game on the like little YouTube, during the show, and it just gets more and more depressing.
Oh, it must have been torture for you.
Well, I recorded early that day,
you knew what was...
Yeah, but halfway through the game, I'm like, I think I'm just going to go do my show.
It did kind of show up early, didn't it? It was just...
The first play.
Oh, that's right. I forgot the opening kickoff was...
Anyway, we digress.
Let me check my notes. No, let's see. We've covered your voice and football, neither of which... That's okay. That's the way it goes around here. Yes, I'll get right to the question that it usually takes me half an hour to get to. Why do you do all the things you do? What's the juice?
Slack. Slack is really the glue that holds my life together. And, you got to do something, right? So, and my goal, I think, since I was a kid, since I had my first job, delivering papers, I think, was my job. Yeah, 6 a.m. and, 20 below zero with the bag on the bike kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, great job as far as building some sort of resilience.
True.
But I quickly realized, I don't want to be under anyone's thumb.
Okay.
I've been lucky to build this crazy little bookstore up to the point where I have some freedom. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit free, which, and I think when you have the freedom to choose what you do during the day, mm-hmm, there's potential to actually get more things done than, if someone was telling you your list. And, and I try to do that with the people that work with me, give them, ultimate freedom. But it's hard because there's things that have to be done every day. And it's not like I don't do anything. I mean, I'm in the bookstore every morning when it's 20 below, packing up the orders. And, but then again, you get a little slack, and you can do the things that you wouldn't normally be able to do, I guess, if you were having to clock in at 8 and clock out at 6. But that means sometimes you're clocking out at midnight,
There is the other clock, isn't there? Yeah, the owner-operator clock. Slack, what a great way to put it. First, I thought you were referring to Dear Freddy, but
no,
you're referring to time. Okay.
No, I'm referring to the Church of the Subgenius, which is
Eddie,
one of my churches.
Would you say that again?
The Church of the Subgenius. which is sort of a joke religion that was formed back in the 70s, 80s, and Slack is their sort of main, you know, philosophical excuse for the universe. And it's given me a lot of solace in my life, you know. Praise Bob.
Praise Bob.
And the beautiful thing is, you know, here we are in Viroqua with this wonderful legacy of Freddie Slack, who is this
himself
awesome boogie-woogie piano player back in the 40s who no one remembers anymore. But here we sit in his father's garage. I mean, his father was the first person, Charles Slack, who first car in town, the first garage, the first gas pump, right here. Right where we're standing, this building. So, and his house was right behind us, behind the war memorial there, where mm-hmm. he grew up. So, you know, it was a reaffirmation of this wonderful cosmic principle to discover Freddie Slack when I started digging into what Viroqua is all about.
I remember way back in the day when I used to operate a cash register at the Viroqua Food Co-op. Mm. An occasional Slack would come through. And I won't use any names, but it truly depended on what part of the family and what generation, because when I would bring up Uncle Freddie or Great Uncle Freddie, I would get the, "We don't talk about him," or, "Yeah, what a guy, huh?" It's like, I'm getting the picture here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if I had, if I was a writer, which maybe I am, if I can find that someday, I would definitely write a book about this guy.
Would you?
I spent a few years sort of digging into everything I could find, and I interviewed his fourth wife, and I interviewed his son, and, you know, found out all these, went to Capitol Records and, like, defragged the whole, like, well, how did this company start? And wasn't Freddie one of the partners? And the head of legal there up on the 12th floor was like, well, yeah, you know, if truth be told, if, you know, he really owned a quarter of this company. And the funny story is, Johnny Mercer, who, mm-hmm. you know, is known as the founder and, you know, head of Capitol, was Freddie's best friend. And Freddie was like the house band when Capitol started. He had the first number one record on Capitol. And this is, you know, there was only three record companies and they were all on the East Coast. And these guys in 1940 were like, yeah, let's just do it on the West Coast. And everybody thought they were crazy. And then the war happened, and there was no shellac for their 78 records. And they got a partner in who had a warehouse full of old records, and they melted them down.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
You can do that?
It's a fabulous story. Wow. Yeah. But Freddie basically, my theory is that because he was embroiled in some alimonies and some patrimonies his ceremonies, that he couldn't, like, be a partner in this thing. So it was kind of like under the table. So he kind of got jacked out of his place in the history of Capitol Records.
I was going to say, because it's not in my memory anywhere that Freddie did fabulously well as a executive vice president of Capitol Records.
No. Not so much. He lived his own life. I think he had a freedom that, he ran to the edges, you know, and sadly he died, you know, alone in Hollywood in 1964 as the Rolling Stones were doing his song Down the Road a Piece.
Down
you know
road.
Yeah, it's just a sad story. But
wow, you get to work on that book, will you?
Yeah,
it's good stuff. I'll buy a bunch.
I think it's going to be called Beat Me Daddy.
Because, A to the Bar?
Yeah, A to the Bar. That was one of his, you know, hit classics.
Oh, it sure was. I got to tell you, it's thrilling when one of our enlightened volunteer DJs does occasionally do a groove of Freddie. And there's that incredible piano. And it's just, you know, you can't not move. It's wonderful stuff. Well, here's to Freddie. I'm glad he came up.
Cheers.
Cheers. Eddie, what's with books? Why is your world full of books? Why is your building full of 12 trillion books or somewhere near there?
Yeah, well, you know, they exist. and it's like time, you have to deal with it. And it's the sad thing is we throw away hundreds of millions of books every year in this country. And the ecosystem of books is equivalent to the ecosystem of our planet. It is quickly being screwed up beyond repair, meaning that the friends of the library groups, the kind old ladies who would normally take your donations no longer do that, and the little bookstores are no longer there. And so when grandma dies and she has a house full of books, there's no place to give them to. So we feel, I feel, it's very important to kind of be that person, even if it means you take in 10 boxes of Reader's Digest and 18 boxes of quilting books.
I've seen some of those boxes.
You know, because in every box, there's a gem. You know, that's what I've realized, you know. Never look a gift horse.
Okay.
And, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I've loved books since I was a kid. I never went to college, so I was kind of self-educated, and I put that energy and money that I would have spent in college to buying books, and that just became a bit obsessive. And, you know, I needed a way to justify my addiction, so why not start a bookstore?
Let me back up a second, because you spoke with such reverence when I asked you, what's the deal with books? And you had the sound of an actual responsibility, like a cosmic responsibility, to do something about books. And I had never, I guess I haven't talked to you enough, I'd never experienced that angle from you before. Do you feel a responsibility to take care of books?
Yeah, I do. You know, on the local level for sure, and on some larger level, let's say, like getting the word out, talking to some of the players in the world of books, like, how can we deal with this? How can we, you know, I issued a challenge to Jeff Bezos some years ago.
You're our good buddy, Jeff.
Challenging him to a duel over the books, you know, on Amazon, because Amazon has just basically destroyed the entire infrastructure of, like, the universe, but especially books. You know, they started out as this great idea, like, let's sell books on the internet. Whoa! You know, and I look at what happened in the last 20 years with them and the last 20 years with us, and I'm glad I'm not Bezos, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
So anyway, he never responded to my duel. But if we could transform this thing, and why can't we, you know, put energy and money into having a bookstore in every little community?
Mm-hmm.
And because it's not just a place to go buy widgets, right? It's that third space that we're all searching for. You know, it's not home, it's not work, it's that other place where we can go and feel comfortable, like the coffee shop, or you know, where there's not this hard consumerism of, like, you know, I'm watching you until you leave with something that you purchase. It's like, yeah, I'm gonna sit here and read for a few hours. Like, that's great. And to have, like, kids come in, you know, and experience books, and when you, like, we have this policy where every kid gets a free book.
Yes, so you do.
As soon as I see a kid come in the door, I'm like, hey, you get a free book. And it's just that startled transformation of, like, what the heck is this place?
That doesn't happen.
Are you serious? And then it's like, that kid will sit there for 2 hours, you know, because they know they get to choose something. They have that agency. It's not just like, mom's going to pick out this book for you. Now, mom still has to, like, you know, approve the book.
Oh, there's that.
Yeah. But, you know, so that's one of the beautiful things. But yeah, if we, the whole ecosystem of books is just so terribly, you know, brutalized because of just the way the publishing industry is, the way the bookstore industry is. So I would love to be a part of that in the future. Now, who knows how that'll happen. But yeah, I do see it as a mission, you know, just like a priest sees their work as, you know, something beyond working for a couple hours a day, you know.
Right. Right. I don't know if there's an answer to this. Are there a whole bunch of other people in the country, in the world, who share that vision or that notion or that wish?
I think so. I think that, unfortunately, most people who have bookstores are trapped in a little, you know, in our capitalist system, right? If you're going to start a bookstore in a town, you're paying huge rent. You're paying, and the space to allow you to say yes to those people who are like calling you saying, hey, will you take donations? Will you take grandma's books? Most bookstores won't because they don't have the space. You know, they're paying ridiculous amounts of money for a very small space.
For a small hole, yeah.
And so I think booksellers in general are very idealistic. We're all on the same page. We're all in the same tribe, you know. We want to create this community space for our community. We want to educate people. We want to entertain people. I just was very lucky in that I was given this huge warehouse 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I could say yes. And quickly the warehouse filled. You know, if I was given a shopping mall tomorrow, I could fill that in about 3 years.
Are you listening out there, folks? Does anyone have a small town to spare that you could gift?
Well exactly. You know, and my the problem here is that I would love to create a book village here in Viroqua. And if I had this idea 20 years ago, it maybe could have happened, but it's not going to happen now because of the real estate and, you know, the amount of buildings that are available. Yeah, which is great because we've created this thing here in Viroqua that, you know, is not a single identity. It's not like, why do you move to Viroqua? Oh, well, it's because of this. You know, we don't have any guru here who's like, you know, the reason we all moved here. And, you know, even though I'd love to have three or four more bookshops up here in town to create that bigger draw for people to come, we're already doing it. You know, there are... I don't know how many people come every year, but man, I would bet there's a couple thousand that come specifically for the bookstore.
Yeah.
And every one of those people ends up buying gas and buying lunch.
Yep.
And doing some other shopping.
Yep. Maybe a room. Maybe, yeah, there's all kinds of...
And it's the same thing with all the other things that bring people in, the fly fishermen that come in. It's like, oh, there's a bookstore. So, you know... It's a very symbiotic relationship here, and it's beautiful, this town. We're very lucky.
I remember one of our neighbors on Main Street, who's a fly guide, was beaming with pride as he was filling the van with four or five guests. And he turned to me and said, they're from Montana. And I thought, oh, man. They came from Montana to fly fish here.
Yeah.
This says something. This is... It's very cool. We are a multi-purpose destination, aren't we?
Yeah, we really are, and we work together so well. You know, the amount of people that come into the shop
that are
like, oh, the lady at the co-op told me I should come to this store. The lady at the grocery store, the cafe, you know. And it's not like anyone's telling you to do this.
No.
We just want to.
Not in Viroqua. There's no one telling
like
you to do
this. We all have
this
mission to like make your visit just a little better.
Yeah. It's a unique energy. It's for any of us who were big city kids in other places, it's unique. It's just, in my life, this is the first time I'm at townie. You know, I'm a big city kid who owned a farm. This is the first time I'm in the marvelous in-between, you know, in a town of 4,300 people.
Yeah.
Who talk to each other, who do stuff, who know things, who rely on each other.
Well, me too. I mean, I've spent most of the last 20 years living outside of town in the country,
right,
with other people, and now for the first time the last 6 months I actually have a home in town. And it's very cool, you know, to have your neighbor's kids playing in your yard, and to have
absolutely
it's great. It's really a great town.
Welcome to town, buddy.
Well, thank you.
Who'd have thunk 10 years ago?
Yeah.
Eddie and Ed. Townies?
Never.
Nah. I do want to keep going with books, but I need a breath. My guest today is Eddie Nix. You are listening to Conversations. Thank you so much for tuning in. We do appreciate it. Stick around. We'll be back. Ed Hollihan with you this morning on Conversations, talking with Eddie Nix. We just happened to be talking about, imagine that, talking about books when we took a brief break there. How did all this get started? You said in passing, well, when I got the building 20 years ago, how did this get started?
So I moved back from California in 2004 and moved to Viola.
Mm-hmm.
And had all these books and put them in storage and realized that I have a problem.
A book problem.
A book problem. And as I said, you know, the simple way to look at it is like, how do you justify your addiction? Why not start a little bookstore? So in 2004, I looked on the internet, which was not the internet of today.
No.
But eBay was there, and I had never looked on eBay for anything. And I searched out something like, you know, bunch of books.
Nice.
And I see this auction for 50,000 books.
50,000.
Yeah. No description, no pictures, just a guy's name, Dave, and a number, right? And I'm like, oh, that sounds sketchy. Might as well check it out.
Where was online?
eBay.
Okay.
So it was an auction. It was like, I think the opening bid was $2,000. And so I call the guy and I'm like, well, what's the story? And he's like, oh, I'm just a contractor, but, you know, it's a whole warehouse floor full of books. This guy died years ago and, you know, we're just clearing it out for the condos and we were going to throw them all away. And I thought, well, maybe someone wants them. I'm like, oh, no. Listen, if I give you $2,000 and drive out right now, will you stop the auction and let me have them? He's like, yeah, sure. So I didn't have $2,000.
Well, sure.
But I borrowed from my mother, the first time I had ever done that.
Thank you, Mom.
I think the only time. And drove out to Connecticut, sight unseen, thinking I'm either going to die here or this is the rest of my life. And it turned out to be this warehouse full of a dead book dealer's backstock that had been sitting there for 10 years since he died.
And 10 years.
No one had paid the rent, and they were doing so. So I ended up spending 3 months in Connecticut in the middle of the summer looking for boxes and pallets to box up all these books, and ended up boxing up 2 semis full of books. Of course, I didn't have the money for the semis, but when I called one of these companies, they were like, well, we'll give you 30 days. I'm like, great, send the trucks. And I drove back to Wisconsin a little ahead of the trucks, and we got to this building, and I happened to realize, oh, I haven't really asked the landlord if this was above, this was below, this is in the building in Viola where the post office is.
Sure, yeah.
Right on Main Street, beautiful old building, 100 years old, and the down, 3/4 of the downstairs was empty, and the post office was in 1/4 of it. And so I talked to the landlord and said, hey, can I rent this space? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, great. I have 2 semis full of books coming. And they showed up. We moved them in. There wasn't room to even slip a piece of paper between the pallets. It was so packed. And I spent the next, you know, 4 years unpacking these books and building shelves and organizing them and putting them online and starting to kind of sell things here and there on the internet. When no one from Viola really ever came in that door, you know, you walked up the steps and you go into the vestibule and you go to the left to the post office and there's this other door to the right with a glass, you know, door, and you can see in there, there's like 100,000 books, but no one really ever came in, you know, once in a while, but it wasn't like a big reading community that was excited about this bookstore. Plus, we were never really open. You know, I don't think I ever really opened. But then shortly after that, what happened first? The tornado. Yes, the tornado came, which was probably 2006. I don't know.
Yeah, in there.
And ripped off the little bit of the back part of the building, sort of the add-on part and part of the roof, and started leaking, and it was just a nightmare.
Not good for books.
And the landlord said, "You got to get out. I'm going to take down the building." And I said, "I'm not leaving. You know, either you sell me this building for cheap or, you know, call the cops or something, yeah, try to get me in, because there's no way, you know, I was trapped." And God bless him, he said, "I'll sell you the building." And the bank across the street said, "We'll give you a loan." And I'm like, "Yeah, I've never even had a bank account here, you know." They were like, "You don't have a credit rating, you know."
Yeah.
Okay. And somehow they, you know, they lent me some money, and we were there. And then the flood came, and that was like
this
the
is
next
why they
year.
Call you lucky, right?
You know, we still haven't had the plague, the locusts. But yeah, then the flood came, and we had to clear everything in the post office out, rebuild it. I think Jeff Miller and Frank Wildingway were the people I hired to like rebuild the post. Yeah, I'd never met those cats before, and they were down there, you know, and we put it all back together. Organic Valley gave us a semi truck to put behind the building to move all the books into while we could clean out.
So that's what you did. Okay.
And we cleaned it all out. And then a couple of years later, a guerrilla philanthropist gave me the warehouse. Mm-hmm. And that's about all I can say about that.
I understand.
Except
yeah.
that guerrilla philanthropy is really something that America needs to embrace. We have way too many people with way too much money and way too many empty spaces and creative people and entrepreneurs. Yep. And, you know, I think if, you know, in small towns, if buildings were given to artists, entrepreneurs, creative people, that there could be a renaissance in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to happen without that kind of, you know, juice. So, you know.
You're right.
We're lucky here because we have had those kind of people.
That's true.
That have looked beyond themselves.
This radio station is just another testimony to
and it. And the Commons and some other places.
Keep going.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. You know, so I think this town could be looked at in that way if some sociologist, economist just wanted to do a case study on guerrilla philanthropy.
Why don't you and I get that degree that we never got, and it'll be on guerrilla philanthropy. It could even be a master. It could even be a doctorate, Eddie. We could take this as far as it goes.
I don't want to be called doctor.
How about doc? I always like Doc. In fact, that's what I insist on. So far, I haven't met resistance. Every medical provider I've had in the past, whatever, I call Doc, and it seems to be okay. Tell us about the... I've noticed that you have other things besides books in your warehouse. Could you tell us a little bit about...
Well, you know, music was always a part of it, and when I named it Driftless Books and Music, the idea wasn't necessarily live music, because it wasn't going to happen in Viola. The reason was because when we got this stuff in Connecticut, there were pallets of sheet music that came along with it, many of which are still in the basement of the warehouse, unpacked 20 years later, because how many copies of Paganini's Ninth Symphony can you really sell?
Yeah. In sheet music form.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, you know, but then that evolved when the warehouse came about, and people like Joe Hart would be like, "Hey, my buddies are coming through town. Can they play at your bookstore?" Why not? You know, we got enough space. And so we started to do these shows, and then those people went on the road and talked to their friends, and then they'd call and they'd come. So after you know, 5 or 6 years, we had a season in, I don't know what it was, 2018 or something. Well, it was before COVID, where we did over 100 events.
No kidding.
And we just maxed out. And I said, okay, I'm going to say yes to everyone, right? And it was like 3 or 4 shows a week, you know, and there'd be like 4 people at the Tuesday show with this band. But somehow it all worked out great. Everybody had a great time. The band's like, you know, I was writing checks. I think I spent like $20,000 just on music that year, like that didn't come back. But it was the investment in the community, you know, and now there's music all over. It's amazing, you know.
That's true.
We don't really have to do too much. And I can say no to 90% of the people who contact us, you know, and pick out those real gems that really resonate with the kind of music I want to see in that building.
Right.
You know, which is kind of this stringy, folky, grassy kind of feel to it, you know.
Well, your guest list, your show guest list is clearly curated by someone, some mystery person. I mean, it's lovely. It beats, for my taste, it beats porridge. You know, you just throw everything out there. If you can sense the impresario's taste in things, it makes for a much better season. It just does. It's whether it's classical or folk or anyway. That's my speech on porridge.
So we were real lucky to have all these musicians kind of find our place, and we're really, you know, in a perfect place as far as music, live music goes, because we're in between the two major, you know, centers of Chicago and Minneapolis. In terms of every band that comes across the country touring has to go to those two places. And what do you do for a week in between? Right.
Yep.
And there's a lot that we could develop here in Viroqua if we were really to be like, hey, you got a band? We'll give you a massage and a, you know, nice meal at the cafe.
Long list, yeah.
You know, if we could bring in some crazy people, because, you know, are we paying for motels this week or are we going to fly fish in Viroqua?
Right.
You know?
Right, let me think about that.
Yeah. So, yeah, the music has been an incredible, incredible part of this whole journey, and I've met so many people that have become important in my life through that. I just feel really grateful about it.
Boy, I bet there's a exponential increase. I'm imagining your life before and after. Exponential increase in contacts, in friends, in longtime friends, and what a boon! What a boon! Thank you, music.
Yeah.
Let's hear it from you.
And it's so cool to get like a postcard from some band they're like, hey, we were just thinking about our show 10 years ago at your place.
And sweet.
Yeah.
That is sweet. Do you talk to the beer cans, Eddie?
Well, the beer cans are supposedly, technically, there's a beer can museum in the warehouse too, which started when I was a kid. And, you know, I used to collect beer cans from when I was like 5 years old, right? And my parents encouraged it, you know.
They did.
Right. I mean, today, it's like, you know, kid digging in the garbage for a beer can. Get out of there, you know.
Really?
My mom would, like, they'd go to Europe for their, you know, semi-annual trip. And my mom would come back with half her suitcase full of empty beer cans for me, that she would literally dig out of the garbage and have a great time with it. And so I started collecting beer cans, and then, you know, we got all this space in the warehouse, let's put them up. And then people started going, oh, you want beer can collections? So we got 3 or 4 other beer can collections.
Hilarious.
And, I don't know. And now, I don't think many people realize it, but we're in a heyday of amazing beer cans. Like, imagine all these craft breweries that are around. And all the artists that they're working with for this limited can that's only there for like 3 months.
A limited can.
And no one's saving them. Right. It's pretty crazy.
I'm sensing a thread in your life, Eddie.
Wow.
There's this stuff out there.
And for about
a
year.
And no one's doing anything about it. And damn it, I'm going to do something about it.
We got
to
save all the beer cans, Ed.
What a great... This is obviously a sub-mission for you, but what a great Oh, I didn't think of submission. That's nice. Oh, okay. Turning the page. How do you get them up there? Those cans are like 25 feet.
No, I know. My buddy Russell came over like 1 year, and we put up all those shelves. We just basically cut a bunch of wood really thin, you know, and once every few years, a squirrel finds its way in. I'll come in the morning, and there'll be like 200 beer cans on the floor, and it's like, oh, okay.
Great, great idea for a children's book.
Oh,
the squirrel that runs through your beer can. It would be fabulous. Okay, you and me. Okay?
We'll do it.
We'll do it. I don't know what you can tell me, because you're a business guy, and some things have to remain for you to know. Can you talk about 2025 at all in terms of the warehouse?
I think we're just going to try to survive, you know?
Yeah.
I've really scaled back the music and the events. We have the second store now downtown.
Yes, you do.
Metaphysical Graffiti with the awesome Bad Axe Records.
Truly awesome.
Peace be to Scott, who's just an epic, epic guy. And that record store has just amazed me. You know, there'll be days where no one will come into the bookstore, and like there'll be 20 people buying vinyl records next door, and I'm like, what did I do wrong here?
Nothing.
No.
It's something you did right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's been great. 2025, you know, there's nothing that's like super exciting that I'm gonna like reveal here to you.
Right.
Yeah.
So, well, what I'm fishing for here is you're not going to quit, are you?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay, good.
No.
That's really all I wanted to know. If you say, I'll keep things going, then most of us know what you mean. So
yeah, this is a pretty hard thing to let go. I mean, even if someone came and made me a stupid offer for the
whole...
I'm kind of having fun, you know?
Let's talk about that for a second. Seriously, that's nowhere in the notes either. We all know people, not from intergalactic stories about tiny businesses that turned into trillions, but we have people in our lives who had a great idea, did something, and then someone came along, or some entity came along and said, you know what, I'd like to have that in my whatever, or I want to open one in Austin, or I want to...
Mm-hmm.
You would have to think twice, wouldn't you? I mean, if somebody made a big, fat, stupid offer...
Well, you know, all I do is go somewhere else and make another bookstore, which...
Like, that's a good point.
Why
that's
try that again when that's you got good something point. Good going? You know, I don't have any kids, so I don't have any, like, worries about the future in terms of, in a perfect world, I'd find the right people to work this place in the next few years and be able to, like... give it to them, right?
Yeah, okay.
Just like that building was given to me,
right.
And all the books, many of them were given to me, you know, and have this place continue. You know, I don't want to sell the warehouse so that, you know, three people can have rich condos, you know, that what's the point? This is a very unique place. I mean, people every day come in and go, my God, I've never seen a place. You know, this is better than Powell's. I've been to the Strand and this is, you know...
You mentioned two of the holy names in book selling. Yeah.
Right. But it is a unique place, and you just don't see this anymore, so it has to be preserved. So, yeah, that's my goal, is to die and give it away.
And give it away.
Yeah.
You could do worse, my friend.
Yeah.
You could do worse. I remember the first time I met your vinyl collection, before there was a Bad Axe Music, I mean, upstairs at the warehouse. I forget how many tens of thousands of albums. And honestly, my first thought is, I wonder how good the floors are, because this must weigh... I mean, records are heavy. Any of us who's ever moved one box of records knows. And here you are with... What's the square footage up there? Anyway, packed... You talked about a slip of paper. Packed tight with vinyl.
And yeah.
Wow.
Whenever we have a little money extra, I... call the Amish guys and like, we need more shelves, you know.
It's need shelves.
They'll come over and put up a wall's worth, and yeah, the bottom, you know, 4 feet is always vinyl.
Yeah.
And Yeah, we were really lucky to get a big classical collection
you
one
sure
year.
Were.
And, you know, it hasn't moved since you saw it, let's just say.
Well, I like continuity. That's a good thing. Clarity is
And
good.
I love that vinyl's coming back. And,
big
you know,
time.
I'm definitely an analog guy versus a digital guy.
Okay.
And I think there's real beauty in these artifacts and not only preserving them to preserve them and looking out here in the studio at this beautiful wall of vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the community has provided this station, but there's magic in the artifact, you know, in an age where we just need a digital copy. Wow.
How many stories have you heard of a university or somebody dumping a collection? Well, we digitized it, so we don't need the vinyl anymore. So what are you going to do?
Well, this is what Google did. They scanned millions of books and they guillotined them. They cut off the spine to make it go through their machine so they could scan them and then threw them in the dumpster. And this is like, it was the only copy of that book. Oh, well, we made a digital copy. Well, we can't see it, you know, because Google got into their whole, like, you know, copyright deal, and now those books are not even accessible. It's just a nightmare.
I tell you what, on that image of guillotining the spines from books, I got to step away for a second.
Okay.
Don't go anywhere, okay? Because I'm having far too much fun.
All right.
My guest today is Eddie Nix, and you stay right where you are, okay? Okay. We're back. My name is Ed Holohan. You're listening to Conversations. My guest is the inimitable Eddie Nix.
What does that mean?
I have no idea, but it's here in the notes. I read it. You know, I'm like one of those television newscasters.
Like whatever's raconteur. Like,
what? What? Huh? It's time for the question that I've been wanting to ask you since the last time we talked. Who was Edward de Vere, and why should we care about him?
So Edward de Vere was the 17th Earl of Oxford over in England. He was born in 1550 and apparently died in 1604. And many believe he wrote the works of Shakespeare, or was behind the works of Shakespeare, or possibly single-handedly funded the English Renaissance, both in theater and in print. So he was a fascinating character who, back in the 1600s, was canceled from history.
The English are famous for that.
They are, yeah. He was definitely an early cancel culture casualty. But, yeah, I've been fascinated with this subject for, God, you know, 20 years, if not more. It started when I acquired a collection of Shakespeare books, a couple thousand, from a dead professor. Peace be upon him. And thought, well, you know, and I had been doing theater for most of my life, and I taught theater at the Youth Initiative when it started.
Okay.
And directed all those plays, some epic plays. And every year, the good Waldorf people would say to me, but you have to do Shakespeare. And I'm like, I want to do Camus. I want to do Brecht. Let's do a play on Emma Goldman, you know.
And, there you go.
And no, but why can't you do Shakespeare? You know, it's like everyone does Shakespeare. I was so sick of Shakespeare.
I bet.
And then I got this collection, and I thought, oh, man, how can I get rid of these books? And so I thought, well, I'll go to a Shakespeare conference and maybe they'll let me sell them. So I called up all the Shakespeare conferences, well, the one, and they said, no, that's crazy. Used books? No, we don't want you. And then I found this other Shakespeare conference, which was like about the authorship. And I was like, I remember that. Francis Bacon and the Freemasons. Oh, that sounds interesting. And they were like, bring it on. Come on, bring your books.
Sure.
So I went and I set up, you know, 1,000 books in this conference hall. And the people loved it.
Where was this? You can put a place on this?
This was Michigan, I think Ann Arbor.
Okay.
You know, maybe back in 2007, 8, something like that. And I've been going back ever since. Every year I go to this conference, it's like my one little, you know, quasi-academic, you know, sojourn that I get to make somewhere in the country. You know, last year it was, we were in New Orleans and Denver and East and West Coast. And somehow I drag these books all over.
Attaboy.
And it's kind of just an excuse to be at this conference because I love it. It's like these black sheep academics, you know, that are exploring this very forbidden topic, which is totally safe. You know, it's not like we're looking into conspiracies that, you know, the FBI is going to knock on your door tomorrow. It's like, no one cares if I think Shakespeare wasn't Shakespeare, which is not the way to talk about this, of course.
Right.
We have to differentiate the author Shakespeare from the gentleman from Stratford.
From the grain hoarder.
Who never taught his daughters to read. You know, it's like, let's start there. Why don't you think Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare? Well, he didn't teach his daughters to read. And I've been obsessed with this topic, which is an awesome topic. And yeah, at this point, I'm pretty convinced that this guy blew one of the largest inheritances ever in English history. I mean, he was the highest ranking earl, had, I don't know, maybe 50 or so estates that were, you know, part of his patrimony. Blew it all in like 20 years.
How so?
Well, you know, the critics want to say, well, he probably just drank it all away. You know, it's like, well, that's a lot of money. Funding his theater troops, he had at least three, Oxford's Men, Oxford's Boys, the Paul's Boys, these boy companies, men companies. He entertained for the Queen all the time. He published all kinds of stuff, whether or not it was him writing it or him paying for it. And there's the peak of this came out like maybe 7 years ago or 5 years, a couple of years ago. There was a guy named Bob Prechter who put out an electronic book. He never printed it, but it's like 18 volumes. It's something like 6,000 pages. Not only claiming that Oxford was Shakespeare, but that he used up to 150 other sort of that publications and voices, right?
Oh,
so
okay.
He's going, well, here's this guy who published this epic pastoral poem and then never did anything else, and we know nothing about this person. Or here was the barber from Oxford, you know, who's like cutting the kids' hairs, who supposedly published this, you know, epic poem or this play. And so he's kind of gone through with a fine-tooth comb and read everything in Elizabethan literature and was able to, you know, sort of pinpoint what he thinks Oxford was responsible for. And I think his motivation was, look, we have to make the English language a world-class language. You know, at that point, it was sort of a gutter language. It was not what it was today.
We're talking in the day, in De Vere's time.
In the 1550s, 1560s. So not only create the illusion that there's this English Renaissance going on, but actually craft the language. I mean, Shakespeare alone, what, coined some hundreds or maybe 1,000 words out of Greek and Latin you know.
Goodness.
And then there's all the others. So it's a fascinating. So I spend most of my free time reading very obscure scholarly, you know, papers on printers and the booksellers and the stationers during this time, because no one's really looked into that side of this authorship debate. So it's fascinating. Yeah.
I remember the specific line, because we did, I think it was 2012, we talked about this on Life on the Radio. And you said, name me another great writer who didn't have a copy of anything he wrote. And you were referring to, you know, Shakespeare. Huh? It's unthinkable. You know, the high school kid who does five poems has 10 copies of each. There isn't a writer in the world who doesn't archive their stuff.
Or that has their books in their will, you know, and granted, okay, you know, his will is a whole nother, you know, nasty little thing to look into. But he didn't have any books that he left to his, and yeah, it just goes on and on. And I love, my favorite thing is to actually have an English professor that comes into the bookstore and, you know, well, what do you do? Oh, I teach English. Ooh, you know, and like,
okay. let's go, you
want to be triggered? You know, it's fascinating because no one else cares, but right. those folks care, you right. know, their entire career is based on this idea that English literature is based on this genius who this never went to school.
Single person.
And so to kind of break that down with people and see their resistances and why and how, you know, and it's usually just pretty stupid. It's like, well, yeah, I heard about that back in college and it was just stupid. You know, really? And then you give them a book and then, you know, next year they come back to the bookstore. I've been looking into this.
Yeah.
But they're hard nuts to crack. Whereas the theater people, no problem. Well, yeah, sure. And the history people, yeah, bring it on. English professors, no way. But there's a new generation. There's younger people that are like taking over these positions in universities that are way more open, that weren't sort of indoctrinated into the sort of historicism and literary criticism where it's like just the text.
It also occurs to me that Shakespeare is a substantial industry. I mean, the name.
I mean,
being Shakespeare.
The Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, which, of course, the birthplace wasn't the birthplace. It wasn't even the house
that's
there now. But this is just a fraud. You know, they're making millions and millions and millions of dollars every year selling this like fairy tale to everybody who comes to England. And they're the most obstinate, stupid people that refuse to debate. Okay, I mean, there's like challenges of like tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars to anyone who will debate this from that side. They refuse. You know, we'll give $50,000 to your favorite charity if you just come and debate this. Silence.
There's a lot of quotes about how telling silence is, and I think this might be appropriate. So back to Edward. Here's this fabulously wealthy guy, and he was a party animal, you say? He was a...
In his time, yeah.
Yeah. Now, in that day, when you say he would entertain the queen, does that mean she would come to one of his places and he would foot the bill for some fabulous party? Is
That happened, but he was also in charge of a lot of the entertainments, okay? So,
at the palace?
At either Whitehall or, you know, different places where the queen would go to. And there's a big mystery about, well, you know, because a lot of these records are just sort of mysteriously gone, right? It's like, why don't we have records of the Stratford Grammar School, for instance, except for those years where William would have been there, right? So there's a lot of that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think he just kind of was like, that was his life. The queen was his life, and the play was his life, you know? And I think when you look at something like Hamlet through that lens, it becomes the most autobiographical play ever, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in all of the plays, you can find biographical fingerprints. Look at Lear. You know, three daughters. He had three daughters. A son and a bastard son. He had a son and a bastard son. It's just, it's fascinating.
It is. At worst, it's fascinating.
Exactly.
And then, boy, there is no limit.
And now we have this excellent little Shakespeare festival in town that's growing every year.
Yes, we do.
And they just got a grant from the Wisconsin Humanities. Good job, Liam, if you're listening.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and apparently they're doing The Tempest this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Funny how things go, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you put something out there and...
But like books are so, you know, we've been publishing books too. We have this little imprint called Ramshackle Press. Yeah. So we've done about 7 books, I think. and this magazine called the Okooch Mountain Echo, which is now officially gone. We decided to shelve it. Yeah, it was a great project, but you know, it's hard to wrangle writers together. It's hard to keep all this, you know, and you can't really pay people. And are we giving this away for free? Or are we doing advertising? I don't want it, you know. So we, in the end, we created an artifact that was what, 6 issues, right. And it is what it is.
Right.
I think I'd like to move on to doing more of a, like, Wopsip Nipicon almanac, or that journal, okay. You know, sort of a literary journal that didn't have all the magazine glossy photos,
sure,
and everything.
Sure.
And you're not trying to be topical or, right, like, you know.
Does Ramshackle intend to keep publishing?
Yeah, we're going to.
Do you folks want to keep doing?
Yeah, we
books?
Mainly try to focus on musicians, right? So we did Charlie Parr's book, and we did Greg Brown's book, and the Lois Pair, Palmer's book, you know. So we like that, but we're also doing different local authors. Kim Kafka, her science fiction novel,
yes,
which
yes.
is awesome. The last thing we published was Native American Michael.
Day?
Yeah, yeah, Michael Day. And
just talked to him yesterday.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful book about his growing up as mm-hmm. a Native American person. Mm-hmm. And we're doing a reading on that coming up. But yeah, I mean, once again, this is a labor of love. It's a money suck, you know. You're not making any money.
Right.
It's like, okay,
right,
how much can I afford to, like, throw into this well? But it's an artifact, you know, once again. And you're giving life to someone's artistic, you know.
Amen, brother.
Yeah.
You know what?
We're done.
We knew this was going to happen. We sat down and said, let's go. And it's happened.
Could we just start over?
Sure.
1 minute.
Tomorrow. I can't think of a more delightful hour on the radio. Thank you very much, Eddie Nix. I appreciate you.
Well, thank
company.
You, Ed Hallahan. It's been lovely to see you again.
And thank you, dear heart, for tuning in. Make sure you tune in every Thursday morning for Conversations. Until next time, you take good care.